This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello, and thanks for being with us on this latest podcast into England's past. I'm Charles Rowe. You can join us for new episodes every Thursday, so make sure to subscribe. Plus, we're always keen to hear from you with your ratings and reviews. This week, we're marking 900 years since the founding of Furness Abbey in northwest England, talking us through the Abbey's varied history and some recent improvements that promise to offer a unique perspective for today's visitors are Senior Properties Historian Dr. Michael Carter and Carlisle Castle Cluster Manager Juliet Fellows-Smith.
Hello.
Hello, it's great to be with you.
We will talk first to Michael because you are our monastic expert and we have covered a lot of monasteries and abbeys on the podcast before. Many of them, of course, victims of the dissolution of the monasteries. So I presume the same is true of Furness Abbey.
Absolutely. Its end came in the spring of 1537. So Furness is a ruin, but what a glorious ruin it is. But it was a functioning monastery for 400 years or more. And you can read in the Abbey's history that of English monasticism more generally over this period. And the monastery's ruins are vivid witness to how the lives of the monks who prayed and lived there changed over the centuries and how they reshaped their buildings accordingly. But before we really get going, I think I need to make one thing clear. Yes, this is the 900th anniversary of Furness Abbey, but it marks the first foundation of the Abbey in 1124. And that was somewhere a little bit different from Furness. It was a place called Tolcath near Preston in Lancashire. It wasn't until 3 years later, in 1127, that the monks moved to Furness, the site known at that time as the Vale of the Nightshade.
Ah, very interesting. So they relocated. And for people who don't know the northwest of England too well, Juliet, how would you describe Furness Abbey's location?
Well, we're talking here about the Furness Peninsula, which juts down into the Irish Sea. It's almost an island. It's, you know, it's connected to the mainland and just south of the English Lake District. And of course, today, that location is considered to be a little bit remote by some of our visitors. It's a little bit off the beaten path. They have to come away from the tourist hotspots of Windermere to visit this stunning abbey. But in the past, the sea wasn't a barrier. The sea was an important means of communication. And in the heyday of Furness Abbey, the influence of the abbey stretched out into the Isle of Man and over the Irish Sea and even to lowland Scotland. And of course, Barrow-in-Furness, the town which is right next to the abbey, was a centre of industry as a result of the sea. So it's a really interesting location. And then, of course, the Vale of Nightshade itself is a beautiful, peaceful little dip, really, where extreme weather passes overhead, which creates a strange stillness at the site that we often notice, those of us who work at site. We can understand why this location might have been chosen, because it does feel special. It has all the natural resources that the monks would have needed, lots of little streams running through the site. You know, it's close to the sea, which would have been very significant for them. They have a quarry very nearby for the beautiful red sandstone, rich woods around them. But still today, the location, the sort of the slight dip in the landscape creates a strange stillness and peace that people still respond to.
Yes, and that's a geographical decision by the monks that you see in a lot of abbeys, particularly in northern England, don't you, Michael? I think Byland Abbey is a prime example, and even Revo. They're sort of hugged by hills, aren't they?
Yeah, there's a description of Revo made in the 12th century that still resonates today, describing how high hills enclose the valley, encircling it like a crown. These are clothed in trees of various sorts, preserving the privacy of the vale, and creating for the monks a second kind of paradise of wooded delights. So it gives you an idea that monks were well aware of the geographical location of their buildings, and monasteries around Europe were deliberately situated, not just to create a kind of spiritual and actually in some cases a sort of physical paradise, but also because they were good places to build monasteries, that they're sheltered from the worst of the weather, they have good supplies of water, And they have, as is the case with Furness, they have excellent natural resources nearby.
So that's the landscape covered. We can sort of understand why they chose to build here. How would you describe the Abbey buildings, the ones that we're left with today?
Well, they're quite simply enormous. Furness must be one of the largest monastic sites in the care of English Heritage. And the Abbey is built in a distinctive red sandstone. And gosh, I've been there in all weathers, all times of the day. And they are at their best when they are catching the low sun. And the buildings just glow. And it's no surprise that the ruins have attracted the attention of some of England's greatest artists and authors over the centuries. Now, as we've heard, the Abbey is located in a narrow valley. And although Barrow's only a couple of miles away, Furness still retains a real sense of isolation and peace that it would have enjoyed in the Middle Ages. You still approach the site as people would have done in the Middle Ages, going down the hill, and you go through actually the location of the two great gatehouses. And once you've parked your car, I think most people will probably arrive by car, you continue to follow in the footsteps of medieval visitors. The Abbey Tavern to the north of the car park, it's in private hands. It retains portions of medieval masonry and was likely one of the Abbey's guest houses. You could then go through the 1970s visitor centre, which houses a site museum, and that boasts some remarkable artefacts, many of national, if not international, significance. And once you've paid your money or shown your membership card and you leave the visitor centre, well, the magnificence of the ruins fully reveal themselves. I mean, the Abbey is huge. The church is cathedral-like in its proportions. The East End, where the High Altar was, which were rebuilt in the early 15th century, and it's actually very complete. The nave is heavily ruined, but the West Tower, the far west of the nave, it's this enormous bell tower, one of the last great buildings to go up at the monastery. And it's worth pausing to look at some of the surviving architectural detailing. There's ornament that dates between the early 12th and the early 16th century. You can see the footings of the choir stalls where the monks gathered to sing the eight services that punctuated that day. There are the seats where the priests who celebrated the Mass sat, and they have these remarkably richly carved canopies. There are niches which once housed the images of saints. And like other monasteries, the main buildings at Furness are arranged around a central cloister, and the garth or green in the middle is huge, absolutely huge. Now, the buildings in the East Range, they are remarkably well preserved, and they date between the late 12th, early 13th century. There's a chapter house where the monks gathered each day for a daily meeting. And although it's roofless, it really does retain a power to impress. Flanking the entrance of the chapter house, there are two large arched recesses where the Abbey's books were stored. Now, only two books from Furness's library are known to survive, but we know that it had a thriving intellectual culture, and that the Abbey in around about the year 1200 was home to a monk called Jocelyn, who has left us some very important writings on the saints. And running along the first floor of the East Range was an enormous communal dormitory.
It sounds glorious and huge. Any other sort of little nooks and crannies that you could sort of talk about?
Well, yeah, far from being nooks and crannies, I've hardly started. You know, the refectory in the South Range is gone. That's where the monks would have eaten as a community. But excavations show that it was rebuilt on more than one occasion. But if we are continuing around the site and going to the south, there is the infirmary. It was built in around 1300. Its chapel retains its vaults, its stone vaults, and it's an atmospheric space. And you can see attached to it the foundations of a octagonal kitchen. And just going out to the east and over a small beck, one of the watercourses on the site, there are the remains of the earlier infirmary, which was repurposed in the 14th century to serve as the abbot's house. Now, the abbot of Furness was a very big cheese indeed. And then returning up to the visitor centres, you can see tombstones in the cemetery, and they're surviving witness to the trust that people in the locality placed in the efficacy of the monks' prayers for the salvation of their souls. There are so many lost buildings. We know of an almshouse where poor men and women, and widows rather, were lodged. There was a song and grammar school where the sons of the abbey's tenants were educated for free. And there were various agricultural and service buildings. Well, I see, wow, I actually feel a little bit excited and exhausted just describing the ruins. But I hope I've given you a sense of them and also inspired you to visit. You know, and also I just say there are some brilliant images of the site and information about the buildings and how it's developed over the centuries on the English Heritage website.
From what you're describing, it's an enormous complex with a village feel, but perhaps actually geographically bigger.
In terms of the size of the site, it's more like a little town, I think.
Let's go back into who founded this abbey and why this particular location was chosen. So, Juliet, what's the answer?
Well, Furness Abbey comes out of a really interesting period of history. It comes just before the anarchy, where the daughter of Henry I, Matilda, her right to the English throne was contested by her cousin Stephen. And Furness Abbey was founded by Stephen, using monks from his own lands in France. So the story of the founding of the abbey is really linked in with the early Norman history in this country. And we've talked about the wonderful location they found in the Vale of Nightshade and how suitable it was for their community, how practical, but also how beautiful it was. I'm sure that even all those 100 years ago, the monks responded to its beauty.
So aesthetic reasons, because I suppose they could see the glory of God within the natural wonders, I suppose.
Well, perhaps Michael can speak to that because he understands the psychology of these monastic communities. It's so different, I think, from the way that we take decisions.
Michael, tell us about those commonalities and choosing these locations.
I mean, it would have been, as far as the monks were concerned, and also visitors to the abbey, this is a little glimpse of heaven here on earth. And indeed, monasteries were allegorized as being the heavenly Jerusalem. They were believed to provide monks and nuns with an opportunity to live the angelic life here on earth. It's a foretaste for heaven. And if you think about the standard of accommodation, the built environment for most people, I'm not stigmatizing the Middle Ages, far from it, but it's mainly wattle and daub. And here you are encountering these glorious stone-built buildings. And when it was a Cistercian abbey, for instance, it would have been whitewashed in and out, gleaming. You know, light and whiteness was very, very important to the Cistercians as reflections of purity and heaven to come. Various Cistercian authors talk about the white habits worn by Cistercian monks as being similar to the whiteness of angels. And then this glorious sung liturgy within the walls of the abbey. And monks took really, really good care to sing their liturgy appropriately. The smell of incense, the sweet perfume of incense, the vestments being worn for the mass, even for an austere order like the Cistercians, and the altar plate standing on the altar, it really was a little glimpse of heaven on earth.
Waxing lyrical there, Michael, as usual, and that's great because it's so descriptive and illustrative. It's lovely. Let's talk some more facts. How many people would have lived there at Furness in the monastery's heyday?
It's not documented, but looking at the buildings, I think they rival the great Cistercian monasteries of northern England, like Fountains and Revo in their scale. I think there may have been as many as 100 monks, perhaps twice as many lay brothers. I think I need to explain what they were. They were illiterate men who served God with their labour rather than their glorious sung services. And they would probably also have been a couple of hundred servants as well.
Plenty of accommodation, really. Plenty of space for these
people. I mean, they are
people.
Huge. I mean, you have to provide space accordingly for them as well. And the people who live in these monasteries are strictly segregated. Now, the monks have to have their own accommodation. The lay brothers have to have their own accommodation. Servants have to have their own accommodation. Guests are separately accommodated as well. There is a real kind of sense that you won the overlapping Venn diagrams, but gosh, the monks really cannot be interrupted in the singing of their liturgy. Similarly, the lay brothers have a role, the servants have a role. It's deeply stratified.
How long was it in use as a working monastery? So we're going back from 1124 until
1537, and the monks arrive at Furness in 1127. So, gosh, they're at Furness for 410 years. It's founded in an era of head-spinning monastic foundation, and its subsequent history then provides plenty of material for monastic historians. And actually, it's for historians on either side of the debates about the relevance and vibrancy of monasticism in late medieval England, the causes of the English Reformation, the dissolution of the monastery, and I'm looking forward to talking more about this later.
Another thing that people might like to know is how the site evolved, how the site layout changed over the 900 years that we're talking about. So presume it started from humble beginnings.
Well, actually, I think it was from the outset planned on a very, very ambitious scale. But there were constant building works at the site, and these affected all the major abbey's buildings. Now, one of the reasons for this is that the site is badly affected by subsidence. The monks built their abbey on a waterlogged site, and many of the structures then had inadequate foundations as well. And in fact, that's a problem that continues to affect the site to this day, and I think Juliet might have more to say about this presently. But there were also changes in religious observance and affiliation that led to major building changes. Now, the monks that originally settled here belonged to an order called the Savignacs. They were one of the various monastic reform movements that emerged in the years around 1100. But in 1148, all Savignac houses, that's Furness included, merged with the much larger and the austere and powerful Cistercian order. Now, the Cistercians had definite and strict ideas about what the art and architecture of their monastery should look like. And uniformity was important, so austerity, no colour, no pictures, nothing of great value, as Aelred of Rivo put it. So the poor monks at Furness had to demolish their church and start again. And then in about 1400, they had to rebuild the east end of their church again because of subsidence. And the tower is in an unusual position for a major church at the west end. You'd expect it over the crossing. That's where the forearms of a church come together. But because of the waterlogged site, it just wouldn't support a tower in that location at Furness. Yeah. Actually, I also need to mention before we move on a gatehouse chapel at Furness. And this is at the main entrance to the site. You pass it as you go in. And it was built in around about 1320. Now, we know that pilgrims travelled to Furness to venerate an image of the Virgin Mary. That's the saint to whom the abbey was dedicated. And you can still see a platform in this chapel that may well have supported this very image.
And another thing that we should probably mention to potential visitors is, Juliet, the extra bits of support that are around the stonework. Could you tell us about those?
Well, in recent years, we've done a huge amount of conservation work at Furness Abbey. As Michael has explained, the site is a site which provided what the monks needed. They needed fresh running water. But unfortunately, that has a downside. We have a number of culverts running through the site, little streams running through the site, which means that the ground doesn't have the stability that you'd expect when you've got an enormous stone structure built on top of it. So actually, underneath this stone structure is timber. It's almost a little bit like a raft. And of course, over 100 years, hundreds and hundreds of years, there's been significant movement. So in recent years, since 2007, when we noticed a very large crack in the wall of the presbytery, one of the most important parts of the abbey, we have done extensive conservation work. So we've underpinned the structure, we have soft capped the structure, we have filled the hole with lime mortar, we have replaced stone, we have conserved stone. So really, we've shored up the structure from underneath, from on top, from the side. Every part of this has involved real experts in the field. It's been incredibly painstakingly, lovingly done. But throughout this period, a large metal cradle has supported the structure that was installed shortly after the crack was found. The cradle, which local people will be very familiar with, is no longer necessary to support the structure, but it's still in place whilst we're monitoring this movement. We believe that we have fixed these problems of movement for the moment and hopefully for many, many years. But due to the nature of the construction of the site, this will always be a very needy ruin and will require a lot of TLC. But in my opinion, it is absolutely worth it.
So heaven on earth, Michael, but it still comes with practical realities, doesn't it?
And also, I do think it's a big thank you to English Heritage members and our visitors that ruins take a huge amount of maintenance. You know, you look at a broken down building and you think, hey, it's seen better days, hasn't it? But the amount of care and actually money that has to be lavished on ruins to stop them completely collapsing. And the ruins of Furness Abbey could quite easily have collapsed on more than one occasion in the past 100 or so years if it hadn't been for some really drastic intervention. So thank you to English Heritage members and everybody who supports us, because we wouldn't be able to do it without your support.
And speaking of collapsing, and just winding back the clock into our story, was there ever a chance that the Abbey could have been at risk of attack by Border Reavers from Scotland?
The Abbey is located in quite an exposed geographical position. And actually, it's a region that's pretty soaked in blood. And early on, from very early on in the Abbey's history, warfare and disorder had an impact on its history. Now, in 1134, a group of monks left Furness to found a daughter house a little bit further north in Calder, in what's now Cumbria. But a few years later, a Scottish invasion. Now, Cumbria was very much contested territory at this time. A Scottish invasion forced the monks to abandon the site and return to Furness. They were refused entry and therefore set off for Yorkshire, ultimately settling at Byland. That's another English Heritage site well worth visiting. But the Scots do keep on returning, and Furness is a target. Now, the depredations caused by this border warfare are recorded in a 14th century manuscript from the monastery that I recently looked at, and I published extracts of it in the local archaeological journal. For instance, in 1316, the Scots sacked the monastery itself, burnt some of the monastery's farms, carried off its livestock and possessions. And there was also a huge human toll. We're told that the Scots carried off into captivity many of the abbey's tenants and even some clergymen, and that many were killed. The manuscript continues that the Scots stayed at the abbey for 4 days and caused so much damage, which depleted the monastery's ability to sustain itself, that the community had to disperse itself to other Cistercian monasteries across England for 2 years for the monastery's finances to recover. And this would scarcely have happened when in June 1322, King Robert Bruce of Scotland invaded. Now, the Abbot of Furness had to pay him a ransom so that he didn't pillage the abbey. And the manuscript describes how the abbot was also forced to provide the Scottish king with hospitality at Furness on the 7th of July that year. Now, the abbey had a castle on Peel Island off the coast of Barrow, and they received in 1327 what's called a license to crenellate this. That's add fortifications. And that's because of the risk of invasion down the coast. Though in actual fact, for most of the abbey's history and the castle's history, it seemed to have functioned more as a fortified manor for the abbot to retreat to for more of a holiday than for protective purposes, it must be said. I just want to add that the Abbot of Furness from the outset had very important feudal and military responsibilities and powers, and that's because of the border location.
I see. So very strategic position as well. Any other challenges that the abbey population faced in the medieval period?
Yeah, well, monasteries don't always play nicely with their neighbours. And one of the disputes that Furness finds itself with a neighbour is documented in that 14th century manuscript I was just talking about. And this concerns properties at Aldingham. That's in, is that Cumbria or Lancashire? I'm never quite sure. It's Cumbria now. It might have historically have been Lancashire. But anyway, Aldingham, not far away from the abbey, at the end of the 13th century, have this dispute. And it gets really, really violent. And I think some of the monastery's lay brothers are killed. They have a massive row with the Abbot of Fountains over some properties. And I think that leads to a violent affray as well. And the monastery is also badly affected by plague. Now, this 14th century chronicle mentions how on the 9th of August 1349, the plague arrived at the abbey And so serious was the outbreak that it killed 42 monks and 9 lay brothers. Now, I really struggle to get my head around what it must have been like living through such a level of crisis mortality. The manuscript doesn't tell us how many monks were left, but gosh, what we know from other monasteries suggests it was probably in single figures. And when I'm standing in the ruins of that great infirmary hall I was talking about earlier, gosh, that was built only decades before the plague struck. I can't but think of the monks who died there in the beds arranged along its sides in agony due to the plague in 1349.
It's just worth reminding people just how serious the plague, also known as the Black Death, was across Europe. About 25 million people estimated to have died, according to Britannica.
Yeah, I mean, the low estimate for the proportion of the population in England to have been killed is about 33%. But it's been revised upwards. In some areas, it probably was closer to 2/3. And descriptions that are often written off as sort of medieval hyperbole about entire populations of villages being wiped out, well, they probably do have some truth in them. And thinking about that many people at the one single monastery being killed in the space of one late summer, it just makes the mind boggle.
Yes.
I'm very, very thankful for effective antibiotics.
Absolutely. It was caused by an infectious fever, and that originated with the bacterium Yersinia pestis. The disease was likely transmitted from rodents to humans by the bite of infected fleas. Again, I'm referring to Britannica.com, but I think that's a trustworthy source. So, yes, a terrible time in Furness Abbey's history, certainly. But there are some lighter moments. Obviously, the Abbey did become very successful, didn't it?
It's hugely successful in however you want to look at it. And I think the starting point has to be spiritually. It is a spiritual powerhouse dedicated to the Blessed Virgin Mary, and the monks sing to the Virgin's praise every single day to God the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost. You know, its religious history is at times extremely vibrant. And also that is shown by the willingness of local elites to invest spiritually and financially in the monastery. If you go into the site museum, there are some absolutely wonderful funerary monuments, especially some effigies of knights. And they speak to me of these local bigwigs turning to the monks to help hasten the passage of their sin-stained souls through the pains of purgatory. In around about, gosh, in the early 15th century, I think it's 1412, Abbot William Dalton commissions the preparation of what's called a cartulary, this two-volumed manuscript containing summaries of all the grants of land to the monastery and its various papal privileges. Gosh, it is a glory of late medieval English manuscript illumination. It's got these fantastic little portraits in inverted commas of the Abbey's benefactors and coats of arms and drawings of Cistercian monks and the such like. But at the beginning, there is an abbot, almost certainly Abbot Dalton himself, kneeling before an image of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And I think that speaks to his religious devotion, the religious devotions of the monks. And just a few years earlier, he'd received special permission for the celebration of Lady Masses. That's Masses in honor of the Virgin at the high altar in the church at Furness. We know of people leaving really quite large bequests to the monastery for the singing of commemorative masses for their souls, for the burning of lights on altars during the celebration of the liturgy. So there's an awful lot in Furness's history that does speak to religious vibrancy.
Despite all that devotion, did anyone ever take their eye off the ball a bit and allow their human faults to sort of take over, i.e. was there any corruption?
Absolutely, of course. Like all monasteries, Furness has an uneven history. There were abbots and monks who were definitely distinguished by the sanctity of their lives, as I've been saying. And Abbot John in the late 12th century, who had a vision of St. Cuthbert, there was Jocelyn, the writer of the Saint's Lives. Okay, you know, I'm just giving the good side before I move on to the other side of the story. But well, in 1249, one of the abbots was said to have been murdered by two of the monks who poisoned the chalice he is using for the celebration of the mass. Ouch. Doesn't really get much worse than that, does it? Mm. There is a monk in around about 1400 who runs away. He was called Robert Hazlow. And this is to quote from a papal document. At diverse times, he had carnal relations with diverse women. Abandoning the order of white monks, that's to say the Cistercians, he then returns to Furness, but left again. On returning, he conspired with seculars, that's lay people, to rob the monastery and to physically assault the abbot. The abbot, learning of this, imprisoned Brother Robert for 2 years. However, he violently broke out, and for the next year and a half, stayed with his friends near the monastery. But remarkably, after all that, he wanted reconciliation and to be allowed to return to it. Gosh, I wonder what the outcome of that was. I think they would have had to accept him back. And then also I have to talk about what happens in 1497. There's a contested election at Furness. The monks can't decide between two candidates for abbot. So a chap called Marmaduke Hubie, he's the abbot of Fountains, is called in as the commissary of the abbot of Citeaux here. That's the head Cistercian monastery. He's the commissary of the abbot of Citeaux here in England. And he advances the candidacy of a 30-year-old monk called Alexander Bank. And Hubie waxes lyrical about Bank's qualities and qualifications. Oh dear, he very, very quickly disappoints. And within a few years, he's been cited at the governing Cistercian General chapter for various irregularities in his life, including incontinency with various women. And then he goes on to bully and intimidate the abbey's tenants. And he seeks to ingratiate himself with local elites by granting pensions or annuities from the abbey's income, which he can ill afford. Well, on one occasion, he bites off more than he can chew, and he double-crosses the Earl of Derby, by far the most important and powerful aristocrat in northwest England, who in 1514 actually attacks Furness Abbey with a force of 2,000 armed retainers. Now, Bank flees to London, taking with him the abbey's jewels and other precious possessions. And the monks get roughed up a bit by the Earl of Derby, who imposes his own candidate as abbot. But anyway, Bank's in London, where he has very powerful backers, including Henry VIII. And he also petitions the Pope for support, and that's forthcoming. And he's restored to Furness, but by the time of his death in 1531, he's left behind a bitterly divided and also an indebted community.
Very interesting. That sort of leads us on to our next question and chapter in the history of Furness Abbey. Now, of course, Henry VIII, as you've mentioned, began his dissolution of the monasteries in the 1530s, and it sort of spread out into the 40s as well. Was Furness Abbey by this time a prime target?
Well, actually, Roger Peel, who succeeds Bank, actually, I think, does quite a good job restoring discipline at his monastery, and it clearly continues to enjoy local esteem and affection. Well, yes, as you said, in 1536, Henry starts the dissolution of the monasteries, and he starts by closing the smaller monasteries. Now, the monks at Furness were a religiously conservative bunch and spoke out against this. And they provided encouragement to the rebels who rose up against the king and his religious changes in 1536. That's the Pilgrimage of Grace. Now, the rebellion doesn't succeed, and Henry was definitely out for vengeance. And a guy called John Paslew, he's the aged and well-respected abbot of Worley in Lancashire, is brutally executed for what is a very, very minor role in the rebellion, and actually on very weak evidence as well. And fearing that he faced a similar fate, the abbot of Furness voluntarily surrenders his monastery to the king in the spring of 1537. Now, this made Furness the first of the major monasteries to fall to the king, and the voluntary surrender was to provide the legal mechanism by which all the other greater monasteries would, by early 1540, be dissolved. A few years ago, I transcribed and published a document, now at the National Archives, that describes the activities of the dissolution commissioners at Furness. This tells how the church was demolished using ropes and other engines, and of the rewards paid to the monks to pack up and go. Now, they were quite a ballsy, but also quite a brave group, I think. Mindful that some monks had been hung up and were still probably hanging from gibbets around northern England, they held out for a better settlement in order to leave the monastery. They'd been offered £1 to go. They hold out for £2 and what's called capacities, so they can become priests elsewhere in the church. The document also describes how the servants are paid off, the settling of the abbey's debts, the sale of its fixtures and fittings, even its livestock, and actually even, how about this, the corn that was still growing in the fields.
Wow. So it was really properly plundered by His Majesty at the time. In later centuries, though, Michael, did the abbey provide any spiritual appeal to Catholics fleeing persecution under later monarchs?
I think fleeing persecution is going a little bit too far, because the people were very, very much still part of society. But anyway, just to rewind slightly, in 1546, the site of the abbey was leased to John Preston. Now, he's a local bigwig, local gentleman. Now, regardless of the fact that they profit from the dissolution of the monasteries, later generations of the Prestons were noted for their Catholicism, and their manor at Furness becomes a centre of what's called Catholic recusancy. There was a resident priest trained at a Catholic seminary in Europe who said mass at Furness for the Prestons and other local Catholics. Now, at the time of the Civil War, this was one Father John Huddleston. He was descended from a family with deep historical connections with Furness Abbey. They're mentioned in late medieval documents from the monastery, and some of them were even members of what's called the Abbey's confraternity or lay brotherhood. Now, Father Huddleston helped Charles II after his defeat at the Battle of Worcester in 1651. The fugitive king hid at Boscobel Hall in Shropshire, a Catholic house cared for by English Heritage today. And the king then sought refuge at Moseley Old Hall, not far away, where Huddleston was chaplain. And it was Huddleston who received Charles II into the Catholic Church on his deathbed in 1685. Furness stops being a centre of Catholicism in the late 17th century. The Catholic Prestons die out and it passes to a Protestant branch of the families. But it really does remain a focus for local Catholic identity. Thomas West, a Catholic priest, a Jesuit, originally from Scotland, but he lives near to Furness, and he compiles a very important history of the abbey, bringing together many of its original documents. I think it's published in 1777. And then in the 19th century, stones from the abbey provide the foundation stones for Catholic churches that are built in nearby Ulverston and Barrow, and they are dedicated to Our Lady of Furness. And I think it's the church at Ulverston has a banner, an embroidered banner, which is a really quite beautiful reimagining of the abbey's medieval scene with the Virgin Mary, two kneeling Cistercian monks and coats of arms on it. It's really quite a remarkable thing.
Listening to this, Juliet, are there any sort of parallels today between Catholicism, the local community, that sort of thing?
I would like to say that even to this day, once a year, a Catholic Mass is held at Furness Abbey by a local school. So its spiritual power and potency is still very present. It still has a spiritual function, even as a ruin. And of course, when we start to talk about the influence, the poetic influence of Furness Abbey as a ruin, we will obviously talk about huge, gigantic figures like Wordsworth. We will talk about Gothic literature, really a Turner. The Abbey as a ruin retains its spiritual power, which is really interesting, I think, to explore.
I'd like to pick up on this idea of the Romantic movement and the famous artist J.M.W. Turner, who I think was immortalised in a film with Timothy Spall, the actor. Turner once visited Furness, didn't he, Michael? What can you tell us about that visit?
He toured many abbeys now in the care of English Heritage and has left some fantastic visual evidence of this. And yep, he visited Furness in 1797. And some of his sketches that he made at the time are at the on the collections now of the Tate Gallery. If you just search on the internet for Turner, Furness Abbey and Tate, it'll come up. And in actual fact, one of the places that he sketched the ruins from, I think Juliet can talk about this, is one of the locations which people will now be able to sit once again because of some works we're going to be doing at the Abbey, and that's the location of the Night Stairs.
We'll talk about those. But before we do, any other people who were inspired to creative outputs by the ruins?
Oh, gosh, you know, Juliet's already mentioned William Wordsworth, whose poetry vividly evokes his boyhood excursions to the Abbey. The Gothic romancer and travel writer Anne Radcliffe visited the Abbey in 1794, and in her mind's eye, she conjured a vision of ethereal white-clad monks processing into the church to sing the midnight service of matins. The young Queen Victoria visited the monastery, and the construction of the nearby railway helped make it a popular tourist destination. Visitors arriving in this way included Nathaniel Hawthorne, the American novelist and author of The Scarlet Letter. I think he was the US consul in Liverpool. And there was also the young Theodore Roosevelt, or is it Roosevelt? I can never remember which one, the future US president. His sister picked, I think, a dandelion that was growing from the visor of one of the magnificent knightly effigies you can now see in the museum. We've actually talked about the religious appeal to Catholics, but I think it's important to mention that it crosses confessional divides. In 1907, the young John Lang, a committed evangelical Protestant, visited the Abbey. And while praying there, he found the inspiration to save his troubled construction company from financial collapse. And he also was motivated there to found the charitable foundation that still carries his name.
You've already teased a bit to these stairs, Michael, but let's bring in Juliet to talk about the present day and some work to reinstate this historic staircase at the Abbey. What can you tell us, Juliet?
So at this very moment, we're doing a programme of works around access at Furness Abbey. They're funded by the FCC Communities Fund. And really, the idea is to increase the access for our visitors around the site. So there's a step-free grass path that we're creating, which will allow more visitors to be able to visit the ruins. But the most exciting aspect is the restoration of the night stairs. So as part of the conservation works we talked about before, we did do some repairs, lay some asphalt on the roof surface that would have been at the bottom of the monks' dormitory. So we now have a surface that people can walk on. So we've now restored the staircase leading up and down to the monks' dormitory. And for me, this is such an exciting development because the lives of these men were absolutely punctuated by prayer. They never were able to receive a good night's sleep. I find that quite hard to contemplate a life without concentrated sleep, because they needed to pray in the middle of the night. So they would have used this staircase at 2 a.m. in the morning, sleeping in their clothes, coming down to pray. And these works that we've just done enable people to walk that same route, to walk up and down into the monks' dormitory, to look at the abbey from a different vista, and really to imagine the lives of these monks and get closer to the original purpose of the abbey as an engine for prayer.
Is this quite similar to what people who know Kenilworth Castle might have experienced, where you can walk up sort of metal and wooden steps high up into the building? Is it a bit like that?
It's not a particularly high staircase. It's not a particularly high level in the dormitory, which I'm sure they would have been glad about at 2 o'clock in the morning as they stumbled into the church to sing their prayers. Maybe they were used to, yes, absolutely. But it is a very evocative short flight of steps, because what you're doing is you're retracing part of the monks' ritual, part of their lives. You're getting close to something really, really physical, really personal, really specific to the function of the abbey. When you walk up, it's just a short, simple staircase taking you into the presbytery and up into the dormitory. But the thing about Furness Abbey is it's so beautifully made, it's so finely made, so elaborate in its detailing, that being able to get a little higher up a little closer to some of the stone detailing to get a different vista. It opens up new understanding of the monument, new views on the monument, and this monument is worth looking at with a magnifying glass. It's a stunning monument.
So visitors will get a monk's eye view, basically, in the daytime.
In the daytime, they have to imagine that it is the middle of the night and they are tired, but they are devoted to God, so they are walking down that staircase to pray.
Just remember, though, that monks went to bed by our standards very, very early, about 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And okay, so yep, they were getting up in the early wee hours to sing the services. So, but they'd got a fair few Zeds in by then, and also that they had a postprandial nap in the middle of the afternoon. After their main meal, midday, they could retire back to the dormitory for a little bit of a nap. So anybody who feels the need to close their eyes after lunch, well, they're in good historical company.
So multiple split shifts within a day, basically. Okay, interesting. Juliet, I'm curious about this staircase still. How many steps are involved, and how much of the staircase is original, and then how much of it is brand new?
The staircase is completely brand new. It's a simple, modern, subtle little intervention. But the thing about the staircase, which is special, is not the physical staircase itself. It's just a simple wooden staircase. But it's the experience that it allows our visitors to have, the way it allows them to walk in the footsteps of the monks in a way that is really conscious. Because, you know, a monk's staircase is always a particularly powerful symbol within these churches of the actual life of these monks.
And does this give us access to a first floor that we would not have had access to before?
Absolutely, it does. It enables, previously there was no way to access the monk's dormitory. So now, following the combination of the conservation works and the access works, visitors can walk up the short staircase and they can stand in the monk's dormitory in amongst the ruin. So you're not standing in a complete room as the monks would have been, but you're standing at the level that the monks slept. You're looking out at parts of the building that they could see, parts of the building that they could not see because there was more building in place at that time. But you're getting a really different, really special vista on the abbey, which always benefits from being looked at from above. There's actually a little hill you can climb next to the abbey, which enables you to look down on the plan. And really, you can only get a sense of the scale by getting high up and looking down at this complex assortment of buildings.
What are the other recent pieces of conservation that have taken place? Because I believe that you've had local TV reporters in the last couple of years come and do pieces.
We have. So I spoke a little bit about some of the conservation works that we needed to do to really secure the future of the monument because of the way it's constructed on very unstable, waterlogged ground. The underpinning works we needed to do, the soft capping, the masonry repairs. Well, actually, during these works, during some of the underpinning works on the presbytery, we found something really quite special, really quite unexpected. We found the body of what we're interpreting as an abbot. He was holding a crozier. He had a ring on his finger. Those items are particularly evocative, and I'm sure Michael will want to talk to them, but I just want to mention something that personally fascinates me. When analysis was done on the bones of this man, it was understood that he had had a rather rich diet and a rather sedentary lifestyle, that he had consumed a lot of fish. And in fact, his diet might have been so rich he possibly had type 2 diabetes. But on his finger, he wore a ring with rock crystal and a bevel on the inside, a sharp, almost pyramid-shaped part of the ring, which penetrated into his finger, reminding him of his religious vows. For me, that's such a very direct physical connection with the life of this abbey. And, you know, we found this body in our conservation works, really quite a special thing. And of course, with the help of our friends group, Furness Abbey Fellowship, we've been able to put the ring and the crozier on display. They funded a beautiful case for us.
Fantastic. Michael, what are your thoughts on the identity of this individual? Do you think it was an abbot?
Quite possibly was, yep. It was discovered in the presbytery, that's the east end of the church. That was rebuilt in the early 15th century. So it's probably that suggests it's a late medieval burial, as does something else. In 1484, the Abbot of Furness received permission from the Pope to wear the mitre. That's the pointy hat worn by bishops that people might be familiar with, and other ornaments that are normally reserved for bishops. And that included wearing a ring. So the presence of the ring really could be quite significant and suggest it was one of the abbots of Furness who died after 1484. Alternatively, it's possible that it could have been one of the two bishops of the Isle of Man that we know were buried at Furness. One was buried there, and I think it's in 1274, and another one was buried a century later, 1375. So, you know, a very, very high status ecclesiastical official. And watch this space. There could well be more to learn about this.
And how recent was this discovery, Juliet?
It was 2010.
And where are the remains now? Are they kept in a drawer somewhere?
The remains are held by English Heritage in one of our stores. But the grave goods that this man was interned with, the ring and the crozier, are on display at Furness Abbey for everybody to see. And that's only possible because of our fabulous friends group, Furness Abbey Fellowship.
I'll just add about, you know, we're talking about storing human remains, and English Heritage has very, very strict guidelines, very strict code of ethics about how we treat human remains, how we store them, and then ultimately how we then rebury them. And they will be treated with the utmost respect.
So we don't have any plans yet on what will happen to them, because I suppose their resting place has been sort of interrupted.
It has. It's been extensively interrupted in order to save the monument. So that will be a question for the future.
Speaking of the future and the present, how important is Furness Abbey as both this local and national monument for people now and for future generations?
Furness Abbey is very much loved by its local community. It really is a very well-used abbey, and one of the ways that this is possible is that when it came into the guardianship of English Heritage, there was a condition that the ratepayers of Barrow Borough should be able to visit the abbey ruins for free. This is a tradition that we've maintained, even though people don't really pay rates anymore, they pay council tax, and even though the council areas have changed quite recently, we still maintain free access for local people at a number of postcodes. And this is a very well-used privilege for local people who use the ruins of Furness Abbey as a green space, as a space for leisure, for reflection, to celebrate special moments in their lives. So there really is a deep relationship between the Abbey and between its local community. We host all sorts of events at the Abbey. The most notable is the annual medieval fair organised by our friends group, which draws about 1,000 people each time, mostly local people, coming to explore this piece of their local heritage. So there really is a sense that it's our Abbey, that it's an Abbey that belongs to the people of the Furness Peninsula, and it's something that they really cherish.
Does it have international appeal as well? Do you get a lot of visitors from around the globe?
Well, Furness Abbey is a little bit of a hidden gem. It doesn't quite have the fame of Fountains Abbey, its great rival, really, because it has quite a lot of the scale of Fountains Abbey. But it does attract visitors from all sorts of different parts of the world, particularly from different parts of Europe, who are often delighted by the riches that they find unexpectedly in this slightly more quiet part of the north of England, just south of the Lake District, away from the visitor hotspots.
Yeah, and I'd encourage any American listeners who are planning a trip to England to emulate Nathaniel Hawthorne and Teddy Roosevelt and make a trip to Furness Abbey. I find it a hugely inspirational and actually a very moving site. Its history, architecture, and many items in its collection are of national, if not international, significance. Mm. And just to continue what Juliet's been saying, throughout its history, the Abbey has provided identity, succour, employment to people in the local area. It was also a landlord, sometimes indulgent, other times bullying. And it is this connection that is very much maintained by the fellowship. And it's this local connection English Heritage is very keen to nurture and maintain. And just to add that, you know, yep, Barrow residents and certain postcodes get in for free, so do English Heritage members as well. And I cannot encourage people enough to visit.
Yes, and I think this podcast really will elevate the appeal of Furness Abbey, and hopefully we'll get lots of people from around the country and even around the world just dropping in and experiencing the wonder of the place. What would you recommend visitors to do during a visit, particularly? Is there a particular highlight of the site?
Something that I've noticed when I've watched visitors in the ruins, and something I find myself doing, is simply finding a place that I can be alone and stand still and look and listen. It is a monument that retains a sense of being somehow hallowed, somehow of spiritual significance. The daylight has come in, the roof has come off of certain parts. There is a sense that it has opened up so that it isn't the complete building that it once was. It's an incredibly evocative ruin, but that sense of power, that sense of potency remains. And actually, I would encourage people, and what I see people do, is they find a place where they can stand alone, and they stand or they sit and they listen to the sound of the trees and the sound of the wind and the sound of the birds. They look at the monument. They find in the amazing elaborate detailing, you know, the gargoyles, the strange faces that are all over the abbey, the geometric detailing, the remains of the paint from when the Cistercians painted it in those stark, you know, monochrome colours, the detailing of which parts of the building are intact and which parts have been destroyed. There is such a lot of history in the physical ruin of the abbey, and such a lot of meaning that people find. And people who are not religious, who are not, don't respond to the original function of the abbey, do feel something special. It retains some of its original purpose, I think, for current visitors.
Yes, I think that's something that I've experienced at Rivo Abbey as well when we recorded the podcast there. It's, you still get the movement of the skies, the movement of the heavens, nature interacting almost more beautifully. It's more enmeshed with the building now that it's a ruin. And I think that's a really special poetic thing. I'm being a bit romantic, but
it's a place to be romantic. I really think it's a place to be romantic, to feel a connection with something bigger and more mysterious than yourself. And I think today people come for that. I think local people use their privilege of free entry to come and stand somewhere that is green and fresh and beautiful, and to feel that they're connected to something bigger than themselves.
Heaven on earth, Michael, as we were describing at the start.
There's hardly anything I would want to add to that. All I would say is come. I think you'll find it was well worth the effort to get there. And if you're anything like me, it'll stimulate your mind and touch your spirit.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Next week, we're at Walmer Castle in Kent to take a sneak peek inside the Lord Warden's private apartment.
That's open for the whole of this summer season. These rooms have never been open to the public before, and it is entirely possible they will never be open to the public again. This may be your one and only chance to come and see them if you'd like to.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.